Welcome to the Poetry Pause, a podcast from a cowshed in West Wales. And this episode, we're delighted to welcome a guest, Christian Donovan. She is a poet and a storyteller, and she'll tell you a bit more about herself in a moment. Emma Baines is here, as usual, Emma Nailit Baines, and myself, Philippa Nuts and Boats Davis. And this episode, we're excited to be considering Carol Ann Duffy. So, Christian, can you just tell us and our listeners what first took you to poetry?
Well, I seem to have written poetry for quite a long time, looking back at my files on my computer. I wasn't conscious that I'd been doing this until the last few years, when I'd been doing a creative writing course and find it very difficult to think of plots for a book. I probably haven't got the length of span of concentration to write a whole book. So poetry, which is shorter, seemed a better option for me. So I've taken to writing poems.
Excellent. And you've written some terrific poems for our Women of West Wales project that we did last year. Yeah. Really contrasting, one really funny and one really moving. So the proof has already been in the pudding.
Oh, thank you.
Now, the poem that you've chosen to bring along today and champion, if you like, do you want to tell us a little bit about it and read it, please?
Yes, it's a book from Carol Ann Duffy's The World's Wife, where she explores the feeling and lives of people that really we know nothing about or very little about. So they're mostly written in the first person, and they are the wives of extremely famous men. So the one I've chosen is a sonnet called Anne Hathaway. We know a little bit more about Anne Hathaway now than ever we did, because there's been the recent novel Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell and several films on Shakespeare. In my childhood, I think I was just told that Anne Hathaway was a bit of a country bumpkin who had no personality and was not important because Shakespeare was so much more important. Mm-hmm. So I particularly liked this sonnet, which actually celebrates her feelings and her obvious love for Shakespeare, which is what one would expect from a wife.
Great. So can we hear it, please?
Yes. It has a sort of subtitle called Item. I give unto my wife my second best bed, from Shakespeare's will. Anne Hathaway. The bed we loved in was a spinning world of forests, castles, torchlight, cliff tops, seas where he would dive for pearls. My lover's words were shooting stars which fell to earth as kisses on these lips. My body now a softer rhyme to his, now echo, assonance. His touch a verb dancing in the centre of a noun. Some nights I dreamed he'd written me, the bed a page beneath his writer's hands. Romance and drama played by touch, by scent, by taste. In the other bed, the best, our guests dozed on, dribbling their prose. My living, laughing love, I hold him in the casket of my widow's head as he held me upon that next best bed.
Lovely, thank you. What do you reckon, Emma?
Oh, it's a brilliant poem. It's just, I find it unexpected and surprising and human, really. I love the idea of being challenged by this woman, because she could be seen as a kind of sad figure who's left the second best bed, like she doesn't matter that much. But I like the idea that the second best bed is where life happens, and the best bed is the kind of outer world that we get to see Shakespeare from. So it's a bit of an insight, and I think she's generally a kind of modern person in that she was very human, she was older than Shakespeare, she had money of her own, and so in that respect I think, you know, she's very human and very real, rather than this kind of in the background wife, which is what may have been traditionally expected. So,
yes, of her, yes. I mean, she sounds quite independent, doesn't she, when you say that?
Yeah.
I mean, there's some lovely metaphor in this poem, isn't there? It's his world, isn't it? It's a spinning world. It's her body is a rhyme. The bed is a page, which couldn't be more appropriate for Shakespeare. I mean, I was very interested in this second best bed. And somewhere I read that actually it was a very generous act of both of them, that they left their best bed to their guests and they habitually slept in the second best bed. It was a kind of very hospitable thing to do.
The explanation was that they'd had all their loving in the second best bed. Yeah. Shakespeare only bought the first best bed, as it were, or the bestest bed, when he'd made all his money.
Right.
So their loving was done in the second best bed. Oh. So that naturally would go to her.
It's
lovely.
Yeah, really good.
It's their world, it's their life, rather than Shakespeare as we see him or understand him. It's real.
Yeah. And it's an incredible love poem to him, really, isn't it? All this lush stuff that is going on in his head of forests and castles. And the last two lines, as I learned, should happen in a sonnet. I hold him in the casket of my widow's head as he held me upon that next best bed. That is so full of love, isn't it?
Yeah.
And unhappy memory, actually. Mm. It's a joyous poem.
It's warm, isn't it? Mm.
Extremely warm. Yeah. Mm. It's very lovely. It's a work of great loveliness. Should we chat a little bit now about Carol and Duffy? What do we know about her?
Well, she was the first appointed woman poet laureate. She didn't get it the first time she thought she was going to get it because the establishment didn't like the sound of her. They thought that she would be mocked for being a lesbian and all the rest of it. So she didn't get it the first time, but the next time of asking, she was made the first woman poet laureate, which is fantastic.
She was born in the Gorbals, wasn't she? But I think they moved to Stafford.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think her dad was the coach of Stafford football team. And she was very early on writing poems, tremendously interested in poetry. And then she went to live, I think, with Adrian Henry when she was just 16.
Yeah.
Which is quite a rebellious act, even, you know, in relatively modern times. And he was quite a lot older than her, I think.
Yeah.
And they were together for quite a long time. She went to Liverpool University.
Mm.
And she won poetry prizes quite early on, I think, didn't she?
Yeah, she won the national poetry competition in 1983. So, she would have been quite young then.
Yeah. Yeah, she was born 1955. Yeah, so
she was under 30.
Yes, And then she went on to win a lot of competitions. And she's published, I think, over 17 collections for adults and 8 for children. So she has been extremely prolific and seems to write quite a wide range of poetry, doesn't she?
Yeah.
I think what's interesting about this book is that it's almost like a kind of concept album, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's got a very strong concept of writing about historical figures' wives. Mm. I don't know if either of you knew a book by a historian called Rosalind Miles. That was called Her Story of the World.
Yeah.
I think that came out in the kind of 70s or 80s. And that was a reinterpretation of history done from the woman, the part of the woman, which was very radical and feminist when it came out. And so this is a similar idea, really. So it's a bold thing to do, isn't it? And the concept is, I think, very strong.
Mm.
Mm. How did she interpret her role as poet laureate? How did she stand out or distinguish herself?
It's just, I find it quite fascinating how she approached being poet laureate. She served the people. She told our stories, and she wrote about kind of controversial issues, the banking crisis, the war in Afghanistan, celebrity culture. She talked about the LGBTQ+ community. So, you know, she wasn't in any way sycophantic to the role. She spoke about real issues through her poetry, and I find that really interesting.
Yeah, she does tackle the issues of the day, doesn't she? I looked up an old newspaper article on her when she just got the laureateship, and she was doing a reworked 12 Days of Christmas poem, which mentioned Afghanistan in the first verse.
Yeah.
So she does not shy away from that. She said something quite interesting about it. I think all poets, to a greater or lesser degree, need to have a finger on the national pulse.
Mm-hmm.
Poetry provides an important alternative voice to journalists or pundits or academics as a way of dealing with things that matter to us all. But she also said she tried to resist doubling up as some sort of talking head as well as a poet. And the campaigns that she got involved in are things she would always have done as a writer rather than because she was the laureate.
Yeah.
So it's a depiction of a woman who is very kind of true to her core values.
Absolutely.
Isn't it, I think.
Mm.
She was quietly very bold, wasn't she?
Yeah. Mm.
While being quite self-effacing.
Yeah. And she uses her poetry in a way that speaks to us all. The language she uses is simple. She said that she likes to use simple words, but in a complicated way, to illustrate real life. And she says that she uses poetry and text as something we turn to when things really matter to us. And I think that's what makes her poetry so relevant, and it speaks to all of us.
Yes. She was raised a Catholic, I think, wasn't she? And I think somewhere she says that she's attracted to the sonnet form because that is, you know, like quasi-religious.
She obviously has a huge depth of knowledge of historical things. I mean, she probably does an enormous amount of research quietly in the background before she publishes a poem of any kind. But the depth of knowledge you feel behind a lot of the poems is quite staggering.
Yeah.
And she even uses Latin words in a few of them. And you think, well, how does she know? How did she know this? She obviously has read an enormous amount about historical figures.
Yes, you get the impression of somebody who's sort of been steeped in poetry, which she, as we know, she has from a very young age, and has made it her life's mission and is really sort of embedded down in it. But as far as I can tell from what I've read of her work, I have never read a poem where I've thought this is a poet showing off her learning.
No, it's accessible.
Yes, and it's about emotion and love. One of the interesting things about her laureateship is how much she did communal poetry events. And, of course, she donated her laureate payment to create the Ted Hughes Award, which has discovered such poets as Kate Tempest, Holly McNeish, Raymond Antrobus, really championing new and perhaps slightly marginalised voices. So that is a really great thing to do, I think. And, of course, now she's professor at Manchester Metropolitan University. But I think she's running a project for people to contribute poems about life under lockdown. Again, a big project involving lots of contributions from different poets. So she's very communally orientated, I think. Mm. Excellent.
I think the going back to the Anne Hathaway sonnet, she doesn't very often write in form. She uses a lot of rhyme in the way she writes and paints the pictures and images in her poetry, but she doesn't very often write a sonnet. So it was quite an unusual thing to find, but beautifully done. It's, you know, I mean, a modern sonnet, so not using the rhyming scheme that Shakespeare would have used, yet keeping to the de-dum-de-dum-de-dum of the pentameter.
Yeah.
And the rhyming couplet at the end that you pointed out.
Yes.
So it's interesting that, you know, the structure, she uses so many different ways of making poetry.
I mean, in some ways, I suppose she's a bit like Picasso, isn't she? She must have mastered those, if you like, classical forms before being able to kind of deviate and invent.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting she's chosen the sonnet to write about Anne Hathaway because we think of it as a form that belongs to Shakespeare and this poem belongs to Anne Hathaway. So it's hers now. It's her form.
So. Yes. And I mean, Shakespeare's renowned, isn't he, for being absolute master of the form. So it's that's, again, a bold act and a thought-through one, isn't it?
Mm.
So would you like to go first, Christian, with your sonnet?
Yes. This one, not actually a response to Carol Anne, but a sonnet anyway. It's called The Antiquarian. The Antiquarian. Alone, immured inside his musty store by boxes full of books, some foxed with mould, he'll press each page, align each spine, behold the racks from Ackroyd through to Zola, sure his first editions, which he has galore, all herald wealth. But once a title sold, in silken tones a customer's cajoled, a price agreed, he'll sulk behind the door to mourn his loved one's loss. Meanwhile, elsewhere, his wife, her life a flyleaf not inscribed with love, diverts herself by reading verse, unnoticed, deep within a wing-back chair, imbibes the lines of images described in cryptic turns of phrase, oblique and terse.
I love that. What do you reckon, Emma?
It's really, really interesting here, because what I really want to know about is what's going through the wife's mind. And if we compare this to The World's Wife now, it kind of, there's the line of division. There's what we know. So in this case, again, the man's voice and his love sonnet written to books.
Mm.
But then in the background, there's a wife and we don't know what she thinks. She's cryptic and oblique and terse. And I'm quite interested to know, I'd be interested to see a poem written from her point of view telling us about this situation.
I mean, I find this incredibly evocative, this poem. You can almost sort of see the dust in the sun rays coming through the window in the books, and you can almost hear the clock ticking.
Foxed it's... with mould, I love that.
Yes.
I can smell the books.
Yes, you can. It's so atmospheric. And, of course, you've done, as I now know, having agonised over trying to write a sonnet myself, you've got the sextet starting... to mourn his loved one's loss, haven't you? So the sextet starts with Meanwhile Elsewhere. It's extremely filmic and atmospheric. The use of language and the rhythm is just so apposite for what you're describing, I think. I think it's a lovely poem.
I actually had in mind a particular local bookstore where when you go in you feel... Does he actually want to sell me any of these books? Can he bear to part with them?
Yes.
And he's sort of lurking behind you as you pull out a book and have a look. You
know,
that probably it's one that he would rather keep.
Yes, yes. It doesn't surprise me at all that you've got a real place in mind that inspired it.
Yeah.
It's really good. It's lovely. Okay, Emma.
So there are two quotes that I'd like to share before my poem. None of what I know is out of books. I prefer tactual learning, touching on the quick of the sore nail of present mobile life. That's Catlin Thomas. And poetry is the music of being human, Carol Ann Duffy. Catlin, the quick of the sore nail bleeds poetry unwritten. This thump of a drumstick heart on its ribcage, this severed bough of tree stumped, churns to pulp, a baked-in bitter art to feed the masses, cut and served up sore, solid as a paper fist, discarded, not flat, off-white, I'm scrumpled, scrunched and flawed, as flesh lives to tear, loves to toy, this scar is truth, I am not metaphor, not metre, my form is loose, it breathes to heave a life, not to hang like some dry cure saltpeter keeps old meat. I'm not just someone's wife, but someone I saw on poetry's song, wrestle the rhythm I've beat all along.
Great. this is a fascinating choice, again, being, you know, such a famous wordsmith's wife, Dylan Thomas. And of course, a lot of us round here know stories about them, how they used to kind of fight and brawl and have a very tempestuous relationship, didn't they? I love this because it's sort of a tribute to him as well in a weird way, isn't it? In its use of language, a baked-in bitter art and scrumpled, scrunched and flawed. She is using words in a way similar to his, but she's making them her own again.
Yeah.
What do you reckon, Christian?
I love it. I just love. I love the rhythm of the sonnet. This thump of a drumstick heart. I mean, that is just brilliant. And also, then, if you go to see the boathouse at Larne, and you see that room that he worked in, it's a mock-up of the room he worked in, and you see all the little bits of paper thrown around, and this is evoked by the scrumpled, scrunched and flawed paper that obviously thrown around and that she was thrown around. I'm sure she did some throwing too, but I think probably she had quite a tough life with him.
Yes, it's funny because that's absolutely the image that sprung to mind with me as well, that one of the boathouse. So what inspired you to write this?
I wanted to write about Catelyn Thomas, and when I started to write this, I thought I'm going to throw in some Cwng Hanner, then... And I was going to do an Englyn, but it was just, I found that impossible.
So what is Cwng Hanner? What is that?
It's a Welsh form. There is some in this. I think I've got it close anyway. The lives to tear, loves to toy. There's an invisible line break, and there's a lot of internal rhyme and the repetition of sound either side of this invisible line break. And I just found it interesting how you could kind of play around with the form and reverse the foot, and it really reflected the way in which Catelyn Thomas spoke.
I couldn't regret marrying Dylan because that's an experience in a lifetime, and he was a marvellous person. Let's face it, it's just that I didn't want to share him with anybody, but you can't expect of me to have someone who's made for everybody all for myself.
Both the way she sounded when she spoke, but also the kind of contradiction between constantly celebrating and loving her husband and hating the way his fame kind of detracted from her own skills and abilities.
Yes.
And right to live her life. So I found listening to her that there was a lot of kind of to-ing and fro-ing, and that's what I tried to reflect in the poem. To me, it began with the rhythm of his poetry. I think the first line reminded me of the force that drives the green fuse, that kind of rhythm. But then she emerged. I tried to get her voice to emerge more towards the end. That's what I was trying to achieve.
Yeah, that's a great line, as flesh lives to tear, loves to toy. That's very evocative. And it's such an interesting subject, isn't it? The so-called sort of supportive wives of highly creative men and the sort of behaviour they get away with.
Yeah.
And it's got so much potential.
Yeah, I love that bit. I am not metaphor, not meter. She's her own person.
Yes.
She's not actually part of his poetry.
Yeah, my form is loose. It breathes to heave a life. It's great. It's really strong. Excellent. Well, I'm going to chuck in my offering, which is a very slight offering in comparison. And then perhaps we should talk a little bit about writing to a form and a structure. What's our own processes about that? And then perhaps sum up Carol Ann Duffy's achievement. We've also got two guest sonnets in this episode, so perhaps one of us can read those as well. So this is called Melania. Melania, what lips his lips have crushed, what grabs, what pussy, I won't consider. And that power play, Princess Ivanka and Jared display, well, I look away, they're so pushy. She shoots for president, she plots as aide, like me she's cover for the Don's changed mind. Medieval queens, fake empathy aligned, we let him look strong, no concessions made. Sphinx-like I stand with my psychocat eyes, Mona Lisa of White House. I don't feel, but perfect art of inevitable deal. With Baron, great prenup, what could be my prize? Ha! It's Trump Tower I want when I get my way. Please join me with God to bless US of A.
Amazing.
Yeah, I think it's the first funny sonnet I think I've ever read. Combines humour with one of my obsessions, which is reading about Donald Trump, because I simply can't believe how awful he is. And it also gets the flavour of this remoteness that Melania exudes. She's almost, as you say, like a statue.
Yes.
Standing there, being nominally supportive. But if you actually put speech bubbles above her head, goodness knows what they would say.
Yes.
Probably yes. Something pretty derogatory, yes. Which you've actually brought out here.
Well, I didn't know much about her. You know, I researched her for the poem. Yeah. And then some of the things I discovered, for instance, she refused to use the bathrooms and toilets in the White House that the Obamas had used. And she wouldn't move into the White House until they'd been completely replaced. And, of course, she stole, practically, Michelle Obama's speeches. And she's done almost replicas of them. So that suggests a highly calculating nature, doesn't it? It's interesting because she is the object of quite a lot of humour, but actually this inscrutability does act as a very effective defence for her. There's a limit to what you can do on the humour when somebody is so inscrutable.
Yeah.
It's pretty clever, really.
And something that really stood out for me is power play. It's like you're playing with the sonnet form and playing with Melania's voice, because none of us really know what she's like. She's Sphinx-like, somebody who's quietly power-hungry. Mm. And I imagine in Christian's poem that the wife who's sitting quietly in the chair could have her own kind of power hunger.
What's happened as well with Donald Trump, he never changes his mind based on political pressure. The few times he has changed his mind, either because Ivanka or Melania have taken some sort of emotional stand.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a bit of fun. So I'd just like to chat with us. How do you approach writing a poem when you know it's got a specific structure and form? What do you do, Christian?
I probably do exactly what we're told in all the workshops we ever go to not to do, which is to write and rewrite and until I get an opening line which is close to the one that I'm happy with. Because if you're writing in rhyme, and I cringe to write in rhyme, I really find it so difficult, then you need to know what the start word, if that makes sense, at the end of the first line is going to be, because you're going to have to find a rhyme for it or possibly more than one rhyme for it. Mm. So to me, that first line is pretty well set. As I start, you may jig around a bit, but it's got its sense and it's got its end rhyme. And then I take it on from there. I would do a bit of research if it's about a person or whatever. Obviously, would write notes and so on about whoever it is. But then I do construct it line by line, which is absolutely as you're told not to do. But I think when I'm writing in rhyme, then I have to know where I'm going.
Well, I don't think it matters what you're told to do. I think what works for you, really. What about you, Emma?
I think I really enjoy the challenge of writing in form. I think it makes you really focus in on what you're trying to say and to be very specific, because, like you say, with the use of rhyme and things like that, it can be very easy to fall into the trap of just finding a throwaway word that just rhymes with where it needs to. So I think I start by having a very clear idea of what I want the poem to say. And then I probably use a thesaurus much more than I do on other poems to find words that say what I want them to very specifically and very clearly, but still fitting into the form. I think I would be more inclined to break the rules than sacrifice what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
But I do think it's a good discipline. I think it forces you to really think about what you're trying to say and what you're trying to evoke in the reader.
Yeah. we all need, I suppose, a sense of the scale of what we're writing, whether we're writing something that's got 14 lines or a long epic poem at the outset. But then it's feeling and response and inspiration, isn't it? And then we put it into form, I think. I actually found this very difficult, and I spent much longer on it over a period of time than I normally would writing a poem, because I decided I did want to go with rhyme. And I'm not sure in my sextet it's correct, the rhyming. There is rhyme in there, but I'm not sure. I looked to Stephen Fry's book on poetry, which is very technical and has got all the things. And then I sort of thought, oh God, I can't be bothered with that. I'm just going to write something that has some sort of rhyme in it, actually, to say what I want to. But it could really bog you down, actually, couldn't it? Mm-hmm. If you haven't, I think, fully explored what your feelings and your reactions are and what was the atmosphere that you want to convey, then form can really hamper you, I think, because it needs to be used in
others. I'm afraid my poems change as I write them in form. They probably wouldn't in free verse or whatever you call it, the blank verse. But actually, with something that's got to rhyme, then I will perhaps change the direction of the poem a little bit to... Yeah. Get the assonance and the alliteration and things working.
Yes.
Which, you know, I find bind me so much.
Yeah.
To try and get the not only the rhymes, but the didum happening in the same way.
Yeah. I mean, the great thing is we can choose the extent to which we use these constraints or not, isn't it? Mm. The other thing we should mention is Caroline Duffy's whole volume, The World's Wife, are persona poems. Mm-hmm. They're poems of character. Has anybody else notable done that? I mean, Robert Browning did it, didn't he, in My Last Duchess, historically. But have other people used this approach?
Well, when I was researching this, the first thing I thought of when I was looking at The World's Wife was The Wife of Bath, Chaucer's Wife of Bath, and what an interesting character she is. She seems very modern in some ways because she is out there doing her thing, living her life, refuses to be judged. She just bats off the judgment, doesn't she?
Oh, yeah.
And the idea of her pilgrimage, so we're with her on an actual journey while she's telling us in verse her story. And again, I think that influenced when I was writing my response poem, because she talks about experience being the way in which she interprets her own sense of self and her education. And I just find that very fascinating. She just seems such a modern voice, even though she's written in Middle English.
Yes, It's delightful when you get that contrast. It's a playful and dramatic aspect of poetry, isn't it, writing in different voices?
I think that up till very recently, poetry was seen as an extension of hymns and prayers and praise for God and for all the natural things in life. It wasn't actually seen... I mean, obviously Chaucer's an exception, but it wasn't actually seen as something that was dealing with personal feelings and emotions. It was to do with the emotions that you were feeling at seeing the wonderful works of God.
Yes.
And I'm afraid it seems incredibly old-fashioned to me. And that really poetry to me is about talking about your reactions to things in life rather than your reaction to God's works.
Great. Well, before we finish, we've had these great guest poems sent in. So the first sonnet is by Angela Graham. She's a former TV producer and screenwriter who's been widely published and won awards. And she has a new collection of short stories out now, published by Seren Books. I wondered if I could ask you, Christian, to read
An Irish Merchant Seaman by Angela Graham, in memory of Clifford Graham, 1912 to 1971. How little sometimes remains of a life. A battered case carries your initials, your service papers, military missile, some postcards. Well, old shipmate, dearest Cliff. Snaps of two ships you served the longest on. Happy birthday, Daddy, card from me, age 10. When I reached 14, you simply died one night. Now, from your logbook, my Sean, rising 16, smiles shyly up and through strong Argentinian sun. First voyage, 1928, from Cardiff. Your Welsh grandson, Cardiff-born, looks like teenage you. You were no hero, but you were once young and underloved. I'd like to right that wrong.
Oh, it's so poignant, isn't it? But you were once young and underloved. Oh, it's a lovely elegiac tribute, really. The second poem is by Mab Jones. She also has been widely published and won lots of awards. She's got two poetry collections out this year. And somehow she finds time to run social media for the famous author Wilbur Smith and his foundation. So thanks to Mab and Angela for contributing these poems, and links to them are in the show notes.
She fell in love with a butcher, master of meats, strimmer of limbs, arms which dealt death daily as a routine. They carried her across the bloody threshold, into a bed patterned with hearts, frilled at the edge with white like toque blanche. He was a seasoned lover, salt-tongued, sweet-chopped. Killer by day, at night he cleaved her body to sweetness, covered her ribs with kisses stronger than pepper. Hooked on him, her yeses were a given, assumed, even when the edges of his temper frayed, his hands serving hell, not the heaven she had known. But she stayed, was never freed, cut her teeth on his love, and learned to bleed.
That's quite powerful, isn't it? What a vivid imagery there.
Yeah.
Any listeners would like to send us over sonnets that they've written, either inspired by Carol Ann Duffy or maybe even inspired by our efforts, we'd love to hear them. Please just send to our Facebook group or tag us on Instagram, tag being Poetry Pause. That'd be great, thank you. So to end up then, Carol Ann Duffy's contribution in a few words, what has she given you?
I think what she gave, well, still gives to me, is the fact that poetry paints these amazing images, and that it is possible to paint the images in language that everybody appreciates and understands. Her poems come over as natural and unforced, though I'm sure that each one takes hours and hours and hours to craft.
She celebrates for me individuality, the things we have in common, the little quirks that separate us and make us who we are, and she shares them through her poetry in a way that's really accessible and speaks to us all.
She's given me all those things as well, but I especially love the communal benefits of her take on poetry. And in her volume, Sincerity, the last poem is called Sincerity, and this is the last verse in that poem. Oh, I look up from the hill at Moniac to see my breath seek its rightful place with the stars and everyone else who breathes. And I think that really sums up her kind of approach and philosophy. Thank you, Christian. You've been a tremendous guest. And thank you for choosing this really great poem. We look forward to you coming back again. Thank you, Emma. Wondrous as ever. Bye for now.
Bye.